Good evening, folks, and welcome back. I'm your host, Mark Hall. And what do you say about a week like this one, other than it's probably one of the most tumultuous, and if people are paying attention anyway, and trust me, the waste stream for the most part isn't, disgusting and revealing weeks in perhaps American political history. Certainly when it comes to criminality, the likes of which puts Tricky Dick Nixon to shame. He was a piker by comparison to what we're seeing now at the highest reaches of the FBI, the DOJ, and of course, the deep state. And there are no shortages of places to start either. Even trying to summarize the perfidy we've seen this week in a mere half hour or so is a challenge. 10,000 emails, for example, that show in expletive-laced detail why Hitler got a pass for treason and Trump got tapped. Furthermore, anybody close to him is probably on the FBI's list. But there's a whole lot to talk about on that front, and the perfidy and depth of collusion, criminality, and yeah, I'm going to say it, conspiracy just keeps oozing out like pus from an open sore. Which, come to think of it, may be another decent metaphor to describe the fraudulent blockers of investigation, as opposed to, say, a mere whorehouse. Anyway, we'll get back to all of that, but maybe we need to work up to it a bit. So let's start our look back at the big story from early in the week, because in many respects, no doubt it all ties together, prior to the Tuesday special senatorial election to replace the do-nothing phantom Attorney General Jeff Sessions, your host has said, I believe the people of Alabama were almost certainly smart enough to see through the transparent BS they were being fed about the various women who waited 40 years or so to come forward with stuff that, arguably, they should have talked about decades ago. That is, if it really happened. But I suggested that if Roy Moore was to win, he'd better do it convincingly, because otherwise it was pretty clear the same people that were willing to pull out all the stops and do anything necessary to prevent him being seated would do anything necessary, and indeed, it would seem they did. Here's a look back at how I summarized the events as of Wednesday morning. Let's go! Bucks barely down the street with the green pool way down low. Ain't no sound but the sound of his feet. Machine guns ready to go. Are you ready? Hey, are you ready for this? Are you hanging on the edge of your seat? Out of the doorway, the bullets rip. To the sound of the beat, yeah. Another one bites the dust. Another one bites the dust. And another one gone, and another one gone. Another one bites the dust. Hey, hey, I'm gonna get you too. Another one bites the dust. Well, the media at least has called it. They've been prepping for weeks now. And the deep state swamp has belched a major sigh of relief. Maybe they'll go out and have themselves an intern or two to celebrate. Because so far as the Ministry of Truth is concerned, the only news that really matters today is that former Alabama Judge Roy Moore is not a threat to business as usual. And although the margin of deep state denizen victory was razor thin and contradicted most of the polls besides, and in spite of the fact that Moore on election night refused to concede defeat and had focused on a recount, the deep state fix was already in advance. This came out the next day via Clifford Cunningham and InfoWars about how an Alabama court has ordered election officials be allowed not to preserve electronic ballot records. And some are suggesting, gee, this certainly smells like a cover-up. And let me ask a quick question before we start on this one. You know that there's a fusion center in Utah that is recording everything electronically that you've ever said, texted, wrote, or sent, basically forever? How hard is it, therefore, to preserve electronic records, especially if, say, they were about something important, like a high-profile, highly contested election for the U.S. Senate? You'd think it wouldn't be such a big deal to, therefore, preserve them, now would you? If for no other reason than to preserve the illusion that the election was honest. Yet, now that Roy Moore is gone, the Alabama State Supreme Court has overturned an injunction issued by a lower court in Montgomery ordering election officials across the state, who could have thought it, to preserve digital images of the ballots cast in the Senate race between the Republican Roy Moore and Democrat Senator-elect, or so we're told, Doug Jones. And this order allowing the official electronic ballot records to be deep-sixed came less than 24 hours before the polls opened. And it took less than half an hour for all eight justices, sick, to agree to the cover-up. An unbelievably fast response, said one of the incredulous attorneys. But the key point is this. No recount here, and isn't that convenient? But if we can believe in BS like the integrity of the FBI and the Robert Mueller investigation, this isn't that hard of a poison pill to gag down now, is it? Which leads me straight away to the continuing saga of one of the most corrupt, discredited, lying, oath-breaking, compromised, and yes, politically motivated so-called law enforcement agencies outside of the old Soviet KGB. Why, with the exception of people like John McCain and House Speaker Paul Ryan, who will hopefully resign soon anyway, even Congress is finding it hard to ignore the level of corruption that's being revealed here. And it doesn't help that, kind of like the BP Gulf oil spill, it just keeps on oozing out. Barrel after barrel. So for that reason, I'm going to do quite a bit more than I usually do in the way of extended clips, in particular from congressmen this week, of vitally important things that every American ought to understand about the literally unbelievable, and I realize most Americans are going to have trouble believing, the depth of criminality that infects the Department of Justice and the fraudulent blockers of investigations. And while I have impugned, no doubt about it, the oldest profession by referring to the former director of that criminal enterprise as the Whoremeister, James Comey, I have in fact also used less than appropriate acronyms like the Federal Bunglers of Investigations to describe these pitifully inept rapists of the Constitution and Bill of Rights. I was wrong. There is no longer any reason for a reasonable person to doubt that what's been going on at the highest levels of law enforcement in this particularly corrupt government is so criminally well organized, intelligent, and in fact competent at blocking investigations that there's no other way to soft pedal this. I've done stories for years here that outline the level of perfidy, yes, obstruction of justice, and almost certainly, and now we know it, commission of crimes, and other crimes committed to cover up the commission of those crimes, from mere perjury to false flags and outright treason. And finally, it seems, at long last, and some of them have been trying for quite a while, but yes, a few members of Congress have grown a pair, and others are waking up to the undeniable. Eventually, at least we can pray, even the waystream media will get shamed into covering it. Of course, that'll require some of those who have been complicit in these high crimes and misdemeanors to probably take a fall, along with the law enforcement agencies that they've been working hand in hand with. Over the last couple of days, you've heard me cover a few more of the increasingly you-can't-believe-it-but-it-really-did-happen kind of revelations about the level of conflict of interest in the special counsel circus and railroad job. And that's kind of putting it mildly, folks. It's a bit like saying the guy who drove the getaway car and took out a guard or two for a crew of bank robbers has a conflict of interest when the crooked judge allows him to sit on their jury. Or, more to the point here, I guess, appoints him to be a special prosecutor and lets him choose his crew of investigators, who know darn well what happened, of course, because they were the ones wearing the masks. First, now to set all of this up, I have several clips from some comments made by Representative Jim Jordan, who asked some pretty pointed questions of the latest primary culprits to appear before the House, current FBI Director Wray, and of course the infamous Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, Wednesday, December 13th, and then appeared on Fox News with Lou Dobbs to discuss what had been revealed.
You can't make this stuff up. This story gets worse and worse each and every day.
And at this point, Representative Jordan briefly addresses the fact that, hey, come on, all of these people are as anti-Trump as it gets. That's why they were selected to sit on this so-called investigation, the Mueller probe. Yeah, conflict of interest is a really big deal. At least, in theory, if we had a rule of law, it would be. But there's something more here, and that's where Representative Jordan is headed. Here, briefly, an insert from a question that he asked during the House hearing earlier in the day.
There's been all kinds of stories. PolitiFact reported 96% of the top lawyers' contributions went to Clinton or Obama. But Peter Strzok, the guy who ran the Clinton investigation, interviewed Mills, Abedin, interviewed Secretary Clinton, changed gross negligence, a crime, to the term extreme carelessness, who ran the Russian investigation, who interviewed Mike Flynn, gets put on Mueller's team, and then he gets kicked off for a text message that's anti-Trump. If he kicked everybody off Mueller's team who was anti-Trump, I don't think there'd be anybody left.
So here's where he's really headed. And for that, we go back to the interview with Lou Dobbs.
The anti-Trump text, that's no big deal. I mean, we know everyone on the Mueller team is anti-Trump. You just went through the whole list. But the text message where he says to Lisa Page, Peter Strzok says to Lisa Page, we can't let this happen. In other words, we can't let Donald Trump be president. That shows that he's thinking about a plan to stop one party's nominee from being president. And remember Peter Strzok. He's the guy who ran the Clinton investigation, interviewed Cheryl Mills, interviewed Secretary Clinton. He's the guy who took the exoneration letter and changed the term gross negligence, which is a crime, to extreme carelessness, which is not a crime. He's the guy who ran the Russian investigation. He's the guy who interviewed Flynn. He's picked by Mueller to be on his team and kicked off for these text messages.
Quick insert here, folks. A question for the listener. Do you think it was because Mueller discovered a conflict of interest, which, for crying out loud, they, to use the legal term, knew or should have known all along was exactly why he was picked? Or is it because, oops, he's been caught and we'll cover it up for a while, but we need to take some action really, really quietly right now before this becomes an even greater embarrassment? Maybe we can keep a lid on it. And the timeline and continued obstruction obviously says they sure as heck tried. Representative Jim Jordan picks it up there.
I think he's the central player here, and now we have this text message between him and Lisa Page where he says, we need a plan. He even says this, Lou. He says, we need an insurance policy. In case the American people, in his mind, are crazy enough to elect Donald Trump, we need something else to stop Trump. That's what this guy was thinking at the highest levels of the deputy head of counterintelligence at the FBI. That's what this is about, and that's why we need a second special counsel and should disband the whole Mueller team right now.
And in spite of the expected stonewalling from the FBI director, who basically refuses to answer any questions about the bogus wiretap, as the president once put it, of his transition team, for clearly political purposes, and who it was, and guess who Representative Jim Jordan thinks it obviously was, it's a name that just keeps coming up, that took the bogus materials before the Star Chamber FISA court so that they could get a slam-dunk warrant to wiretap Donald Trump and his team.
Congressman, our staffs have been having extensive interaction with both intelligence committees on our interaction with the FISA court, and I think that's the appropriate setting for those questions.
Here's what I think, Director Ray. I think Peter Strzok, head of counterintelligence at the FBI, Peter Strzok, the guy who ran the Clinton investigation, did all the interviews, Peter Strzok, the guy who was running the Russian investigation at the FBI, Peter Strzok, Mr. Super Agent at the FBI, I think he's the guy who took the application to the FISA court. And if that happened, I mean, think if this happened.
And basically, as he goes on to say, if you had the FBI actively working with the Democrat campaign to, let's just say, manipulate an election, doesn't that kind of reveal the great big lie the American people are being fed here? They covered up the real collusion with the so-called evil Ruskies, all the while Robert Mueller, of all people, was one of those taking enriched uranium to the Russians and delivering it on the tarmac to a Kremlin representative of none other than Vladimir Putin. And then they put what amount to Clinton operatives on the so-called investigative team to blame the opposition for precisely what they're doing. Back then to the interview with Lou Dobbs, where the focus is on two elements, not just the whole bunch of emails from Peter Strzok to his mistress and vice versa, demonstrating how much they loved Hitler and how much they hated Donald Trump, but more importantly, the fact that they were willing to take actions, and that's what the other element is here, in order to prevent, at any cost, Donald Trump from being able to act as President of the United States, first to get elected and then to stay in office. If, as he made so clear, the American people are stupid enough to allow him to be elected and not as capable as he is of protecting them from themselves.
It shows intent, Lou. It shows intent to do something to stop Donald Trump, who was nominated by the Republican Party running for president. It shows they're trying to stop him, and it all has to do, I believe, with this dossier.
The particular text they're referring to says the following. Quote, I want to believe the path you threw out for consideration in Andy's office, another one of the co-conspirators, a reference to Deputy FBI Director Andrew McCabe, that there is no way he, meaning Trump, gets elected. But I'm afraid we can't take that risk. unquote, said Sturzik to his co-conspirator and lover in a text from August 15th of 2016. Again, folks, well before the election. Then he went on to say this, and it's worth repeating, "It's like an insurance policy in the unlikely event you die before you're 40, unquote.
Peter Strzok thought he was saving the world. He's Mr. Super Agent James Bond in his mind. He thinks he's out there doing this wonderful service by going against the very guy that people are going to elect, President Trump. He is no different, and this is scary. He's no different than Lois Lerner, who thought she had to go after conservatives because they're having too much influence in politics. It's the exact same mindset. But here we have the guy who I think took the dossier, the discredited, disproven dossier, fake news, garbage dossier, took that document that the Clintons paid for, took that dossier, I think he dressed it all up and presented it to the FISA court. I think the deputy head of counterintelligence, Peter Strzok, did that."
And then he goes on to outline the important two questions from a legal standpoint about the conspiracy to obstruct justice and literally destroy a sitting president here.
Did they pay Christopher Steele? Did the FBI pay him? It's been reported they did, the guy who wrote the dossier.
Right.
And did they take his work product, the dossier, and present it as real intelligence and take it to the FISA court to get warrants to spy on people associated with Trump's campaign? If the answer to those questions is yes, then this is as bad as anything I've ever seen in government. And if the answer is yes, people like Peter Strzok need to be held accountable.
He didn't get there without help, folks, without cover, and without years of setup, and without a whole lot of other people who knew blankety-blank and well exactly what he was doing and why he was put there. This kind of treasonous conspiracy, in other words, is precisely the reason why the so-called intelligence agencies, like the CIA, have been preconditioning the American people to think that any conspiracy that involves the highest levels of government is verboten to even think about, much less talk about. Tricky Dick Nixon resigned the presidency, folks, because he got caught, even though he had plausible deniability, using a small team of government contractors against what ultimately amounted to his political opponents and enemies list. And here now we have an entire set of federal law enforcement and so-called intelligence agencies actively not only conspiring but acting, and yes, at the very highest levels, to obstruct justice, cover up not only high crimes and misdemeanors, but outright treason, so they can put their preferred candidate in office in spite of her demonstrated crimes, rig an election, and then destroy a sitting president. Here's how Ohio Congressman Jim Jordan summarizes it.
"I'm afraid the answer to those questions is yes, which actually deep down scares me. If this actually happened, the FBI had a concerted effort with people at the top to go after one party's nominee to help the other party's nominee. If that actually happened in the United States of America, and everything each and every day points to more and more likely that that is what took place, that is just, it's sad for our country if that in fact took place. And I think it did, based on everything I'm seeing, all the evidence points to that."
Here next, a really wonderful set of comments and a single question or two from Representative Trey Gowdy, arguably to the American people, but ostensibly at least, to one of the chief criminal players here, Rod Rosenstein, Deputy Attorney General. And guess what? He goes all the way back to previous criminal attorney generals that you may know, like Mr. Fast and Furious, Eric Holder, and his contempt of Congress, and of course, Loretta Lynch Mob, the literal poster child for conflict of interest, which is where Mr. Gowdy chooses to focus.
But when I go home to South Carolina this weekend, trust me when I tell you, no one is going to ask me about any of those issues. They're going to ask me, what in the hell is going on with the Department of Justice and the FBI? The reason we have special counsel, this is a very important point, and you know it, the reason we have special counsel is because of a conflict of interest. The regulation itself specifically makes reference to a conflict of interest. And we don't like conflicts of interest because it undercuts people's confidence in both the process and the result. So let's be really clear why we have special counsel. There was either a real or perceived conflict of interest that we were fearful would either impact the result or people's confidence in the process. That's why we have something called special counsel, and that's why we have special counsel in this fact pattern. And then lo and behold, those who are supposed to make sure there are no conflicts of interest seem to have a few of their own. There's a senior prosecutor who sent obsequious emails to a fact witness. She can be described as nothing other than a fact witness. She's a really important fact witness if you pursue the line of inquiry that my Democrat friends want to pursue. They got off of collusion and now they're on obstruction of justice. She may be the most important fact witness in an obstruction of justice case. And the senior prosecutor for this conflict of interest-free special counsel sent a fawning, obsequious email to a fact witness. And then we have prosecutors assigned to conduct this investigation who donated almost exclusively to one candidate over another. And then we have a prosecutor assigned to this conflict of interest-free team that attended what was supposed to be, what he'd hoped to be, a victory party for Secretary Clinton. And we have a senior DOJ official, Mr. Deputy Attorney General, with an office that used to be two doors down from yours, meeting with Fusion GPS. And Fusion GPS, of course, was paying for Russian dirt on the very person that they're supposed to be objectively investigating. And then that same senior DOJ official's wife, the one that met with Fusion GPS, his wife was on the payroll of Fusion GPS. And then we have a senior agent assigned to investigate Secretary Clinton's email, help draft the exoneration letter, where we changed the language from grossly negligent to extremely careless, interviewed Secretary Clinton in an interview I've never seen, and I doubt you have either in your career as a prosecutor, interviewed Michael Flynn, was actively involved in the investigation into the Trump campaign before the Inspector General found his text. So this agent, in the middle of almost everything related to Secretary Clinton and President Trump, sent pro-Clinton texts, anti-Trump texts to his paramour in response to being told maybe he is where he is to protect the country from that menace, Donald Trump. He said, "I can protect our country at many levels." And then he said Hillary Clinton should win 100 million to nothing. Now think about that, Mr. Deputy Attorney General. That's a pretty overwhelming victory. 100 million to zero. And when I read that last night, what I thought was this conflict of interest free. Senior agent of the FBI can't think of a single solitary American who would vote for Donald Trump. That's where the zero comes in. Not a single solitary American he can imagine would vote for Donald Trump. This is the conflict of interest free special agent assigned. And then he went on, if that weren't enough, to belittle Trump supporters by saying he could smell them at a Walmart in Virginia. This is the person we needed to avoid a conflict of interest. And then he said this, they fully deserve to go and demonstrate the absolute bigoted nonsense of Trump. But he wasn't content to just disparage Donald Trump. He had to disparage Donald Trump's family. This is what he said, Mr. Deputy Attorney General. He said, the douchebags are about to come out. He's talking about our First Lady and children. This conflict of interest-free special agent of the FBI. This is who we were told we needed to have an objective, impartial, fair, conflict of interest-free investigation. So he's openly pulling for the candidate he had a role in clearing, and he's openly investigating a candidate that he has bias against. And then if that's not enough, he says Trump is an effing idiot. What the F just happened to our country? This is the same man that said he would save our country. What happens when people who are supposed to cure the conflict of interest have even greater conflicts of interest than those they replace?
And the answer, folks, seems to be that eventually they get to be either FBI director, or if they're crooked enough and have the mob boss instincts, they can run for president and have people like this to cover for them. As Trey Gowdy poignantly notes, none of us would allow anybody like Peter Strzok to sit on a jury, much less conduct an impartial investigation. And the fact that this oath-breaking reprobate was picked to sit on Robert Mueller's so-called probe speaks volumes. And we'll pick it up there when we get back.
All my knees and pray.
Welcome back now, folks, to the second segment of tonight's show. I'm your host, Mark Call, and we continue to review some of the, admittedly unbelievable things that continue to come out of the cesspool, or swamp, if you prefer, that is Washington, D.C., and its so-called premier law enforcement agency, the Federal Blockers of Investigations. That is, obviously, if you're their preferred dictator. Others, to quote scumbags like Peter Strzok, or at least as close as I can come to it, better just go and F themselves. Because if you don't, for crying out loud, they certainly will. Which brings me back to where we left off with the testimony and questioning of high-level co-conspirators before the House on Wednesday. People like FBI Director Wray and Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. He was asking, basically, why anyone with any integrity would allow a self-important, compromised hatchet man like Peter Strzok and his minions to be anywhere close to an honest investigation.
What happens when people who are supposed to cure the conflict of interest have even greater conflicts of interest than those they replace? That's not a rhetorical question. You nor I nor anyone else would ever sit Peter Strzok on a jury. We wouldn't have him objectively, dispassionately investigate anything, knowing what we know now. Why didn't we know it ahead of time? And my last question, my final question to you, and I appreciate the chairman's patience, how would you help me answer that question when I go back to South Carolina this weekend?
Congressman, first of all, with regard to the special counsel, Mr. Strzok, already working on the investigation when the special counsel was appointed. The appointment that I made was of Robert Mueller. So what I'd recommend that you tell your constituents is that Robert Mueller and Rod Rosenstein and Chris Wray are accountable and that we will ensure that no bias is reflected in any of the actions taken by the special counsel or in any matter within the jurisdiction of the Department of Justice.
Full stop. Does anybody listening to this actually believe a word of that? Does he really think people are too stupid to listen to a single word of the litany of the last 5 minutes of conflict of interest that makes exactly what he just said such a ridiculous in-your-face whopper? And furthermore, are we really stupid enough to believe that the kind of people who would hire and put in place an entire team of exactly this kind of people, and hey, guess what? There are plenty more emails yet to come out. We're blind enough not to know exactly who they were putting in place. Give me a break. But this guy's just getting started, and sadly, he should have been finished a long time ago, like on January 20th of this year. Listen to this.
When we have evidence of any inappropriate conduct, we're going to take action on it.
You mean like the Department of Justice did with your boss when she had an inappropriate conflict of interest-laden meeting on the tarmac in Phoenix? Or when Peter Strzok eliminated the words grossly negligent so as to protect the woman that he'd been protecting all along from criminal charges? Or when he suborned perjury or the destruction of evidence for the same ends? And let's see, when was it, Mr. Rosenstein, that you recommended the hiring of the criminally compromised Mueller? And wasn't this entire team put in place after all of this criminal activity? Folks, this is literally the conflict of interest dream team. And to call this guy a liar does a great disservice to people who merely kite checks and commit perjury.
Of any inappropriate conduct, we're going to take action on it. And that's what Mr. Mueller did here. As soon as he learned about this issue, he took action.
You, of course, didn't hear about it for months.
And that's what I anticipate that the rest of our prosecutors, our new group of U.S. attorneys, our Justice Department appointees, they understand the rules and they understand the responsibility to defend the integrity of the department.
Yeah, folks, insert laugh track here. Integrity, Department of Just Us, who are they kidding?
And if they find evidence of improper conduct, they're going to take action.
Because if there's one thing, folks, that we all know, they know how to do blankety-blank and well by now, it's take action to cover up evidence of impropriety. Before the week was out, we got word that they were evidently using burner phones when they wanted to talk to Hillary, off the record. And there are evidently plenty more emails showing collusion between other members of the Mueller Dream Persecution Team as well. They've got bleach bit, they've got hammers, they've got liars galore, and who are we kidding, folks? If necessary, they have people who will do what's quaintly referred to as wet work. Vince Foster wasn't the first, and Seth Rich, as we've already seen of late, was hardly the last. Let me see if I can summarize a rather lengthy piece pretty succinctly. We are talking and seeing here a level of treason the likes of which has never, ever even been remotely approached in all of American history prior to the last couple of decades. So maybe this next story shouldn't surprise us at all anyway. The same people that aren't particularly hot about preserving, protecting, and defending the Constitution are more than happy to undermine it with a poison pill, if it suits their purposes, the so-called reciprocity bill, where Big Brother kindly might allow those who've begged for a privilege to keep and bear arms in their home state, and if they're good little slaves, carry them concealed, might even be allowed a similar privilege in other states. Well, thank you very much, U.S. House of Representatives. Ain't that special? Trouble is, even that infringement, as we now learn, surprise, 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 has a poison pill embedded in it. Do you think Paul Ryan knew? Called Fix Nix. Nix means nix to your right to keep and bear arms without Big Brother's permission. The national instant check system. And now, just like Obama wanted, and all those who are still there in the Department of Justice, the FBI, and the other TLAs, there are going to be more names on the list for any reason that they later decide they might want to add. Do you need help filling out government paperwork? Beware if you're a Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, or Obamacare recipient. You might end up being a prohibited person. Oh, and for crying out loud, if you're a fugitive from justice, that's the second largest category of people who no longer have their privilege to keep and bear arms. You can kiss your right to self-defense goodbye. Oh, and did we mention? That includes if you have unpaid traffic tickets. Yeah, now you know how it works. Which brings me next to another related story that also isn't new news. Seems like we've got a lot of that of late. But the meta news, anyway, is the fact that some, at least on the very left side of the aisle, are waking up and honestly reporting just how biased their own side really is. I'm looking at Glenn Greenwald from The Intercept, a true journalist, folks, who your host almost never agrees with politically, but does at least find to be a person of integrity and truly a news source that can actually be called an honest journalist. And that's a very good thing. And his headline rings true, although you have to be careful about which humiliating media event he's talking about. It says, the U.S. media yesterday, he wrote this on December the 9th, suffered its most humiliating debacle in ages, and now refuses all transparency about what really happened. Friday, he says, oh, see, this was before the latest humiliation. Friday was one of the most embarrassing days for the U.S. media in quite a long time. The humiliation orgy, he writes, was kicked off by CNN, with MSNBC and CBS close behind, with countless pundits, commentators, and operatives joining the party throughout the day. By the end of the day, it was clear that several of the nation's largest and most influential news, sick, outlets had spread an explosive but completely false story to millions of people, while refusing to provide any explanation of how it happened. The spectacle began, writes Greenwald, on Friday morning at 11 a.m. Eastern, when the most trusted name in news, trademark, spent 12 straight minutes on the air flamboyantly hyping an exclusive bombshell report that seemed to prove that WikiLeaks, last September, had secretly offered the Trump campaign, even Donald Trump himself, special access to the damning DNC emails before they were published on the Internet. And he emphasizes before. And as CNN sees the world, this would prove collusion between the Trump family and WikiLeaks, and more importantly, between Trump and Russia, since the U.S. intelligence sick community regards WikiLeaks as, and he's quoting, an arm of Russian intelligence, and therefore, so does the U.S. media. This entire revelation, continues Greenwald, was based on an email which CNN strongly implied it had obtained exclusively and had in its possession. It was sent by someone named Michael J. Erickson, someone nobody had ever heard of previously and whom CNN could not identify, to Donald Trump Jr., offering a decryption key and access to DNC emails that WikiLeaks had uploaded. The email, they said, was a smoking gun, in CNN's extremely excited mind anyway, because it was dated September 4, 10 days before WikiLeaks began promoting access to those emails online, and thus somehow it proved that the Trump family was being offered special, unique access to the DNC archive, almost certainly, or likely anyway, from WikiLeaks and the Kremlin. It's impossible to convey it with words, continues the honest leftist reporter here. What a spectacularly devastating scoop CNN believed it had. So it's necessary to watch it for yourself, he said, and he kindly provides a link to see the tone of excitement, breathlessness, and gravitas the network conveyed as they clearly believed they were finally delivering that near-fatal blow on the Trump-Russia collusion story. Trouble is, there was, in fact, one small problem with the story. It was fundamentally false in the most embarrassing way possible. Hours after CNN broadcast his story and then hyped it over and over and over again, the WAPO of all fake news outlets reported that CNN got the key fact of the story wrong. The email was not dated September 4, as they had claimed, but rather September 1-4, the 14th, which means it was sent after WikiLeaks had already published access to the DNC emails online. Thus, rather than offering some sort of special access to Trump, Michael J. Erickson was just one other random person from the public encouraging the Trump family to look at publicly available DNC emails from WikiLeaks, as everyone by then already knew had been publicly promoted. In other words, the email was the exact opposite of what CNN presented it as being. And here Glenn Greenwald asks his key question. Just how did CNN end up aggressively hyping such a spectacularly false story? They refused to say. He goes into some detail, as you'd expect a good journalist to do, noting that they claim to have had multiple sources providing them with the false data, but your host can't help but summarize so much of what follows this way, folks. If you're big enough to get away with it, you're probably big enough to make those sources up and then cover your tracks and hide their identities. All of this, though, says Greenwald, prompts the glaring, obvious, and critical question, one which CNN still refuses to address. Just how did multiple sources all misread the date on this document in exactly the same way and towards the same end, and then all feed this false information to CNN? Yes, of course it's plausible that one source might innocently misread a date on a document. But multiple sources, all in good faith, misreading the same date in exactly the same way on the same document, all to cause a disseminated blockbuster revelation about a story that the waste stream is literally salivating over and has been trying to hype for months now? Greenwald goes on to note that all of this is just the last week alone that he's been talking about. Hey, can you help but remind yourself of how many times major media outlets have made humiliating, breathtaking errors on the Trump-Russia story, always in the same direction and always towards the same political goals? He gives a lengthy list of just some of the incredible inflammatory claims that traveled all over the internet before having to be corrected, walked back, or retracted. And yeah, the bogus claims got far more attention than the retractions. Or this week's FBI corruption revelations, I can't help but note. Yeah, CNN demands respect, Greenwald notes, but you'd think they'd be able to earn it, too. Which means that most of all, when media outlets are responsible for such grave and consequential errors, like the spectacle we just witnessed, they better take responsibility by offering transparency and accountability. Very good, Glenn. And your host summary? Is it just possible they don't have a particularly transparent process, but they sure as hell have a particularly transparent agenda? On Monday, I watched a video of one of the more disturbing police state executions that I'd ever seen. And I use that term explicitly, especially in this case, because of just how disturbing this situation was. Evidently, I'm not alone. The video has gone viral. Lots of people are mad as hell at what happened in Mesa, Arizona. And if there's any justice left in this nation, this unhinged, power-mad nutcase will lose more than his job. He's certainly not fit to protect and serve. Yeah, I guess nowadays he could be FBI material. Oh, good grief. And yeah, folks, it kind of makes your cynical host think, look, if you're not Hillary Clinton, or on the take for the likes of her and the deep state at the federal bunglers of investigation, but you still want to pretend to be above the law, you'd better be a felonious illegal immigrant in a sanctuary city like San Francisco, or maybe just have a badge and a gun. Yeah, you know what's coming. Another one of those, gee, whatever happened to the rule of law stories? So with that out there on the table, let's turn to the actual disgusting story itself. Obviously, there have been a number of stories written about this one. The Murder of Daniel Shaver is the name of the National Review's piece by David French. If you have the stomach for it, he begins, I want you to watch one of the most outrageous and infuriating videos I've ever seen. And folks, I don't necessarily advise that, but I certainly think the story is important. Nevertheless, consider yourself warned here, because even hearing about it is admittedly pretty disturbing. It shows, he says, the police shooting of Daniel Shaver in Mesa, Arizona, who was crawling on his hands and knees, crying and begging police not to shoot him. But an officer shot him anyway. The background, says French, is simple. Shaver was a traveling pest control worker. He was in his hotel room, a La Quinta Inn in Arizona, showing off to guests a pellet gun he used for his work. Police responded to a 911 call claiming a man was pointing a rifle out a window. And right there, I think you can see part of the problem that's been so carefully engineered. When police arrived, Shaver was alone with a woman. They'd been drinking, which may now be a capital crime. The police ordered them out of the room. They came out, raised their hands, and got on their knees. So far, things seem routine. Police responded to a call from a concerned bystander. They were concerned that the suspect may have a gun, so they demanded to clearly see Shaver's hands, which is entirely fair and appropriate, and you can see that in the video. Then, however, things got strange, very strange. Rather than asking Shaver and his friend to keep their hands visible, while police, who at this point had guns pointing straight at both of them, approached and applied the usual handcuffs, they were asked, no, they were told, to crawl towards police in a highly specific way. You really have to watch the video, he notes, to grasp how truly strange the demands were. Langley tells Shaver to keep his legs crossed and push himself up into a kneeling position. As Shaver pushes himself up, his legs come uncrossed, prompting the officer to scream at him. I'm sorry, says Shaver, placing his hands near his waist, prompting another round of screaming. You do that again, we're going to shoot you. Do you understand? Yells one of his executioners. Please do not shoot me, begs Shaver, his hands straight up in the air. At the officer's command, Shaver then crawls down the hallway sobbing. At one point, he reaches back. It looks like some kind of reaction to me, folks. Perhaps he started to lose his balance or maybe to pull up his shorts, suggests David French. But it was the last move he'd ever make because Brailsford immediately opened fire. And it occurs to me the audio pretty well brings the point across here. And if you can't actually see it, maybe that's all for the better.
Okay, young man, listen to my instructions and do not make a mistake. You are to keep your legs crossed. Do you understand me?
Yes, sir.
You are to put both of your hands, palms down, straight out in front of you. Push yourself up to a kneeling position. I said, keep your legs crossed!
I'm sorry.
I didn't say this in conversation.
Put your hands up!
Hands up in the air! You do that again, we're shooting you. Do you understand? Then listen to my instructions.
I'm trying to do what you
don't mean. Talk! Listen! Hands straight up in the air. Do not put your hands down for any reason. You think you're going to fall, you better fall on your face. Your hands go back in the small of your back or down. We are going to shoot you. Do you understand me?
Yes, sir.
Crawl towards me. Crawl towards me!
Yes, sir.
Don't talk!
Shaver was hit 5 times, and he was pretty obviously dead before his executioners stepped over the body. David French outlines the last few seconds of an innocent man's life this way. How the man can crawl without putting his hands down, I don't know. As the sobbing man tries to crawl, he reaches back towards his pants and is immediately shot dead. He had no weapon, he had done nothing wrong, and now he's dead. What the police told an innocent, and in hindsight, now that he's dead, law-abiding, intoxicated American to do was this. Follow my highly specific, detailed, very strange instructions, or I'll kill you. There was no need to make him crawl. The police were well in command of the situation, and at no point was there any visible weapon. Says French, I've seen soldiers deal with Al-Qaeda terrorists with far more professionalism and poise. When a man is prone, his hands are visible, and your gun is trained upon him, he's in your power. Unquote. And I guess that wasn't enough for these guys. At trial, the officer testified he thought the subject was reaching for his gun. And if he had a chance to do things over, he'd make the same decision again. Which is why that unstable sadist should never have been doing that job to begin with, for crying out loud. Oh, and by the way, that was your host's little interjection there, if it wasn't obvious. And there I pause, folks. This is why people have a right to keep and bear arms. Because sometimes, and I'm going to say it, really, really evil people are in a position of power, and they think they have the right to execute those that pay their salaries, provide them their weapons, and that at least once upon a time, they knew they were supposed to protect and serve. Not order around like slaves and then execute for failure to comply. David French's story concludes this way. Shaver died trying his best to comply, and yes, folks, he was probably a bit inebriated, which doesn't help, but he was in his hotel room, after all, with a highly unusual, complicated set of commands while under extreme duress. Scared cops, says French, still need to be competent cops, which is far from what we saw here, so I think he's being a bit too kind. And members of the public shouldn't face death because a police officer can't keep his emotions in check. Finally, he says, I know that police have a dangerous job, but they're not at war. And there, folks, is where a large part of the problem lies. Because that is not what so many of them seem to have been taught of late. Nor is it how the itchy 911 finger, dumbed-down but well-conditioned public has been trained to respond, given the series of increasingly transparent false flag attacks on the Second Amendment. Consider just how far we've come from Andy of Mayberry and the idea that a man's home is his castle and that, for the most part, a free people had the right to keep and bear arms, whether they were on the road or in their castle, and police who were paid to protect and serve would have made that their default assumption. Of course free people are armed. Now, in stark contrast, if a peon has a gun, well, you know darn well he must be a criminal. So shoot first and ask questions later. But that was long before kids who even drew a picture of a gun, or for crying out loud, ate a Pop-Tart into the shape of one, inspired so much hysteria from so-called educators that they were kicked out of the public indoctrination cesspools. It seems to your host that the bitter fruit of that so-called education is now patently obvious. People who grow up thinking that you peons shouldn't be allowed to even have a picture of a gun, much less one that looks like a gun to us, your betters, who alone are qualified to give you orders and then execute you if you don't immediately comply, seem inclined to do precisely that, literally at the drop of a hat. Once upon a time, it was called a hair trigger. But now it's, oops, another dead civilian. In this case, though, you didn't even hear oops. And now we've got all kinds of them running around thinking they alone have the privilege, granted by the almighty state, to wear a badge, carry a gun, and execute anybody who gives them some lip or doesn't immediately comply, Achtung. And nowadays what we've seen is that if you have a pellet gun, or somebody even thinks you have a pellet gun, they may dial 911 so you can die. Why, gee, seems like only yesterday, when a neighbor called 911 because he heard an argument in the apartment next door, they'd just take somebody's kids away and put them into the foster abuse system. Yeah, folks, I guess disgusting as it is, we have to think those were the good old days. So I take a deep breath here and continue with French, who says, it's infuriating to see civilian police exercise less discipline than I've seen from soldiers in infinitely more dangerous situations. Remember, folks, the soldier's job, famously put, is to kill people and break things, not to protect and serve, and that speaks volumes. Not one of the men I deployed with, says French, would have handled a dangerous terrorist detention the way these officers treated American citizens. He notes that Arizona law defines second-degree murder as killing a person without premeditation, quote, under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to human life. The person recklessly engages in conduct that creates a grave risk of death and thereby causes the death of another person, unquote. In this instance, he says, the charge fits the crime. The jury's verdict, and this is how many we've seen in just a few weeks, was a gross miscarriage of justice. My heart, he says, breaks for Daniel Shaver's family. And your host will close by saying, this is yet another caution for us all.